Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
I would like to welcome you all to London School of Economics for this hybrid event. I'm Liz Robinson, I'm Director of Bentham Research Institute on Climate Change and the Environment. And I'm really pleased to be here today to welcome both our online audience, and I like to look at the camera, but I never know where to look to welcome our online audience, but welcome, and our audience here in the Sheikh Zayed Theatre. So I'm going to introduce the speakers now, and then there's just a little bit of stuff that I have to say, so bear with me, because, you know, we don't want to hear too much of my voice, but we have to a little bit. But anyway, to introduce our speakers, giving his third and final of the 2024 Lionel Robbins Memorial Lectures, is Nick Stern. Nick is the I.G. Patel Professor of Economics and Government. He's the chair of the Grantham Research Institute, and he's the head of the Indian Observatory at LSE. He was also president of the British Academy from 2013 to 2017, and was elected a fellow of the Royal Society in 2014. But I think for a lot of us, Nick is just a really valued colleague, and for many of us, including myself, he's one of the main reasons we came to LSE. And, you know, the work that Nick's been doing for decades now, very pioneering work on the economics of climate change. And it's really, you know, I think because of people like Nick, we have some optimism now that despite all the stuff that's going on in the world, that, you know, we can tackle climate change and we'll get there and win in the end. And that's why I think these set of three lectures, and this is the third, are just very exciting. You know, I've really enjoyed being in the audience for the first two. Now I have to work a little bit today. We also have with us, I'm absolutely delighted to welcome Rachel Kite. She's Professor of Practice in Climate Policy at the Blavatnik School of Government. You're also a board member of the Climate Policy Initiative. Before that, she was Dean of the Fletcher School at Tufts University and was formerly Chief Executive Officer of Sustainable Energy for All, Special Representative of the UN Secretary General for Sustainable Energy for All, and co-chair of UN Energy. So thank you so much for missing the West Ham game and coming instead to be with us. And you're going to be the discussant after Nick has spoken. So this evening, as I said, it's the third of a series, and what we're going to be hearing about is the importance of finance frameworks and international collaboration in reshaping global trade and integrating climate and biodiversity policies so we can foster the new growth story for the 21st century, a really optimistic, positive message we're going to get. For people who X Twitter, we have a hashtag. I think, yes, up there, hashtag LSE Robbins with two Bs. And this event is being recorded, and so as long as we don't have technical difficulties, it will be made available as a podcast. As always, there's going to be a chance for you to put your questions to our speakers, so, you know, get them planned and start thinking about them. For people who are online, you can submit your questions via the Q&A feature, which apparently is at the top left of your screen, so I hope I'm not directing the wrong place. Please let us know your name and affiliation, because we especially like to know if you're a student or an alumnus who's talking to us. And your questions, if you're online, are going to come through my colleague Martin over there. And if you're in the theatre, it'll be obvious. I'll let you know when we're opening up for Q&A. And then if you raise your hand and wait for me to direct a microphone to you, because if you speak not on microphone, you won't be heard by the... Apparently we had thousands on the online audience the last 2 days. You won't be heard by then, and you won't be heard by anyone on the podcast. And then people listening online will not have a clue what the answer is. They'll be trying to guess the question instead of listen to the answer. And we'll try and get a nice range of questions from our online audience and our audience here in the theatre. So, for the moment, I can now be quiet and sit back and listen to Nick, who I welcome to come and give you a talk. Thank you.
It seems to be bigger than it was the other days. Fine. So, the slides work, you can hear me, and you can see me. All very good. That's a good start. Thank you very much, Liz, for the very kind introduction. Liz is our much valued director of the Grantham Institute at the London School of Economics. And thank you, Rachel, so much for coming. We've collaborated over so many years, and we've got so many more. So I learned enormously from you, and I really appreciate that you're here. So I gave thanks to the Lionel Robbins family and committee at the beginning of the first two, and I'm very happy to give those thanks to the Lionel Robbins family and to the committee again. Last two lectures are already up if you like to watch them on video. The slides are available. They're meant to be public goods. They're much more detailed than I can deliver. They're the beginnings of a book. But in each slide, there's a kind of strap at the top, which is a headline, and I'll be going through them at the pace of the headlines, not at the pace of the detail of the slides. But let me begin not by trying to summarise the first two. Actually, on the slide packs, there are summaries of the lectures, but to see where the lectures take us in terms of what we have to do today. Now, the first one was looking back at how we got where we are, how we generated for ourselves the crises that we face, and the importance of investing very strongly, doing things differently, systemic change, and set the agenda for the new growth story. I set out the growth story yesterday, and that, if those of you here will recall, six big drivers of growth, innovation, economies of scale, resource efficiency, changing in systems, very big improvements in health, and of course the driving force of the increase in investment that we're going to need. So this growth story was setting that out, then asking about the increased investments and systemic change that we need, and going through what you had to do to foster that change. And I emphasised at the end of last time that this is a very different picture of the role of the state than we had in the sort of sad days of market fundamentalism in the 1990s. This is an active state that's helping set a sense of direction in which we have to move, because if we don't, we'll be in deep, deep trouble, indeed generating catastrophe for those who follow. So that's where the ideas took us in terms of growth, where the ideas took us in terms of policy and the role of the state. That is a story of change. It's a story of big change. I argued that the obstacles to that change were in the economy, in the politics, and in the society, rather than in the technology. The technology has moved remarkably quickly, and there's lots of reason to believe it will go on moving quickly. That doesn't mean we take it for granted. It has to be fostered, and that's part of policy. But the biggest obstacles lie in economy, politics, and society. That's why you should all be here at the London School of Economics. That's what we do, and that is where this whole story will be decided. I'm enormously optimistic about what we can do. That doesn't mean I'm optimistic. There's a very big difference between what we can do and what we will do. And our job, in large measure, is to bridge that and take us from what we can do, what we will do. I'm not forecasting what we will do. I'm deeply worried. But it's logically prior to set out what we can do and show it's possible, show it's attractive, before you can proceed on what proceed down that road. And we know enough to start, and we know enough to go strongly. So that's where we were from the last two lectures. There's so much that we have to do internationally, and that's what I want to set out here. So the structure of this lecture is like this. If we're talking about international collaboration, we have to start with understanding what the differences are, and they're big differences between nations across the world, in their vulnerability, their history of emissions, their opportunities, and their endowments. And in order to understand collaboration, we've got to be quite explicit about that. I'll be pointing to a new economic geography as a result of all these changes, and indeed where we have to go. I'll be setting out five key areas for collaboration: trade, technology, land, overshooting, and finance. I'll be quick on land and forests and biodiversity. I did say something about that last time, and fairly quick on the overshooting and the removal and geoengineering. But that is a subject which we have to look in the eye, and that's going to be a challenge. And then I'm going to try to spend more time than on those other issues around the role of the international financial system and the multilateral development banks. Because if you remember from yesterday, if you look at the geography of the investment in these new technologies, it's very tilted to the rich economies and to China. Why? Well, there are all sorts of obstacles, and I went through half a dozen of them. But a very big part of that story is the much higher cost of capital that the emerging markets and developing countries face. So that's where we're going. The collaboration story starts in Paris. I haven't got the time to go through Paris in detail, but it was a remarkable achievement. And many of us remember that euphoric night in December 2015 when the gavel came down and that agreement was established. It was really odds against getting something like that. But the genius of Paris in many ways is to get agreement on an overall goal and then adhere well below 2 degrees, efforts towards 1.5 degrees centigrade, and then to ask everybody to describe what they would be doing. And then once they have described what they would be doing, it's immediately clear that it's inconsistent with the goal. So you go back and you agree to revise over time. I don't think we would have gotten agreement any other way. It's an agreement without sanctions. There's no police force from Jupiter or Supreme Court from Mars that are going to enforce anything here. That is why it is so important to recognize that people are willing to collaborate to go down those roads, but particularly that this is a very attractive growth story and to get the clean to be cheaper than the dirty. That's a key part of this whole story of collaboration. Do go into the details of Paris. It's a very important and remarkable document, and it's had a very big effect on the sense of direction. It didn't actually use the language of net zero, but it did talk about the situation really in terms of net zero. It just didn't use that language. But the advantage of the language of net zero is that whilst there will be some negatives, they're not going to be very big. So if we've got to get to net zero, then we've all got to be at net zero as a city, as a university, as a country. It's remarkable when we did the Stern Review, at that time with the scientists, we were talking about 80% reductions 1990 to 2050, and it's remarkable how many people thought they were in the 20% that didn't have to do anything. So that net zero concept, which came from Paris, although the language wasn't used, was extremely important as well. So you can see how Paris started to fit together. We wouldn't have got Paris unless the new growth story, the climate action drives growth, unless that was beginning to have traction. I'm not declaring victory on that story, but it had begun before Paris, and I think it was an essential part of Paris. So that, no time to go into much more detail, but it did have a very big effect on the sense of direction, and the reason that the costs of solar and wind and so on have gone now to the point where across much of the economy the clean is cheaper than the dirty is in large measure because of that sense of direction. So nothing really that's legally binding in the sense of enforcement, but it did have a very powerful effect. Now let me be very quick. I hope it's going to be obvious, and there's some detail and references here. All the references are available on the in the pack of slides. But developing countries are much more vulnerable to climate change. It's not only inequitable in the sense that they did the least to create the problem, it's inequitable in the sense that it's poor people, poor countries that are particularly vulnerable. Whether you look at the Himalayas or Africa, right across the board, the effects of climate change are much harsher in terms of extreme weather events, in terms of pressure of very high temperatures and so on. If you just think of the Himalayas, for example, the big rivers of that region, if you go round clockwise, you've got the Yellow River and the Yangtze and the Mekong and the Ganges and the Indus, and you go all the way around. Those are rivers which depend on the Himalayas. If the snows and ice go from the Himalayas, you have, and of course with global warming, the intensity of rainfall goes up, you have unmanageable torrents in the rainy seasons, and you have droughts and very difficult times in outside those rainy seasons. Those are parts of the world, including in some parts of eastern China, where the combination of temperature and humidity is likely 50 or 60 years from now, on anything like the direction that we're going, to be such that you can't be outside for more than a few hours without dying. So these are the kinds of pressures. Very important, Africa particularly are vulnerable as well. But we're all vulnerable, whether they're the rich countries or the poor countries. The poor countries are particularly vulnerable. The fragile states, within that group of vulnerable countries, still more vulnerable. And various estimates of just of the climate change over the last 20 years has taken out something like 20% of their wealth already. And in the words of Ronnie Reagan, you ain't seen nothing yet. This is a world where we're at 1.2 degrees centigrade in terms of average global temperature above the end of the second half of the 19th century, which is the usual benchmark. We're going to be at 1.5 degrees within 10 years in terms of the trend. Actually, we were at 1.5 last year in terms of the, including the fluctuation. And we saw last time just how damaging all this was. And the 2.5 or 3 degrees we're headed for, we have not seen as a world for 3 million years, and when sea levels were 10 to 20 metres higher than now. So poor people get hit earliest and hardest. If you look now at the history and geography of emissions, the red line is China, and of course China's growth rate has come with emissions, the very close relationship between output and emissions. You can see that China is now the biggest of the emitters, but still, of course, the United States is still very high. If you look at the per capita story, and at the left-hand side of this diagram, you've got per capita, you can see that China's per capita went past Europe's per capita about 10 or 15 years ago, but it's still way below the US per capita. If you look on the right-hand side, you've got the history story, because the flows of emissions build up into the stock of concentrations, so the overall emissions over time is very important in understanding historical responsibility here. And you can see, even though we've seen China growing very rapidly, it's still considerably behind the United States. And if we all get down to net zero within 50 years, well, within 30 or 40 years, China's got a net zero by 2060 or carbon neutrality by 2060 target. It's not clear that China will ever overtake the United States. Of course, if you put Europe together, that's a pretty big history as well. So it's very important to remember the inequalities in the origin here. And this is just to remind where it comes from. Now, I emphasized very strongly, and let me just pause to emphasize the notion of sustainability here, because in terms of history, that really matters. Sustainability is the idea of future generations having opportunities at least as good as ours. It's basically a symmetry in the right to development. It's a symmetry in terms of rights to pursue your life, which comes through very strongly from the philosophers of the 18th century. Indeed, it goes back in many ways to Aristotle. But it's also there, of course, in the American Declaration of Independence, the equality of the right to pursue, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And that is basically the idea of sustainability, the equal rights of people to pursue their own life. In terms of Martin Sen's language, it's about capabilities. And that's why we pursue the idea of sustainability, but it's also why the history of emissions really does matter, because by emitting, you restrict people's right to development. You make their development more difficult. And that's where the responsibility of the rich countries lie. There is no right to emit. And often you have very confused arguments that, well, you did the emission, so now we do the emission. That, I think, is just actually a rather illogical way to look at it. Because what matters is the right to people to shape their own life. And your actions have interfered with that in the relation to future generations. And particularly, as we saw, interfered with that in relation to very poor countries. So the obligation of the rich world from that history, from that idea of sustainability and basically equality of rights to development, is a story where the rich countries have an obligation not only to cut their own emissions, but also to support other countries, poorer countries, in their task of cutting their emissions. Inequality in infrastructure. Again, I haven't got time to dwell, but if you terms of Rachel knows far more about access to energy and electricity than I ever will, and that is still very unequal. Interesting now, inequality in endowments. This is the endowment of sunshine in the sense of opportunity for solar. You can see that Northern Europe, notwithstanding people like ourselves about to build solar panels, Northern Europe's not the greatest place for solar energy, but it's still a good place for solar energy. Elsewhere, spectacularly good places for solar energy. And you can see the importance of North Africa. You can see that the part of the world which is very heavily endowed with oil is also very heavily endowed with solar potential. Australia looking pretty good, and Namibia and Southwest Africa. So there's a redefinition of endowments in the world that's going to play through into the geography. This is a map of places where, this is my, from jointly with my great friend Mattia Romani, who was here a couple of days ago. These are the places where you start to see those endowments of solar and indeed, of course, of wind also starting to manifest themselves in terms of industrial parks. And you're seeing now activities taking place on the basis of where is the endowment of cheap renewable energy? And that is a big part of the story now. When in very, very long ago when I was at school and did my what was called O-level then, geography, we were taught that, wisely so, I think it's right, that the reason that Manchester and Newcastle and Sheffield were where, and so on where they were was that iron ore and coal were heavy, and so it made sense not to cart them around, but to make your steel where the iron ore was and where the coal was. Now that the economic geography is changing, because if you're going to use, for example, green hydrogen, it's very costly to transport. You can change it into ammonia, and it's less costly to transport. But you can see the idea of the economic geography of making things happen where the new sources of energy are and where they're really cheap is going to start to reshape much of what goes on. It's also the case, and I heard this said very clearly and strongly by the CEO of the world's biggest chemical company, BASF, is that building these things in an integrated way around sources of energy is now becoming much more easy administratively in big parts of the developing world rather than, say, in Europe. So there's a big change in economic geography that's coming that's going to be extremely important. Now, staying with the geography, you've got now, and this is something I'll come back to in just a moment, you've got very big differences in the endowments of... very big differences in the economic activities. China got in very early, and good luck to them because they've brought down the costs for everybody else, but very early in these new technologies. And they went to scale. And now that's something which, of course, makes people worry about the resilience of supply chains. Monopolies should make you worry about technical progress. But it is something that has moved very quickly, and it's something which people have reacted to. They've reacted to it in Europe, reacted to it in the United States. India has its own plans, Australia as well. So you're seeing now very big commitments to building up these new technologies across different parts of the world. This is an example of how the Inflation Reduction Act, which is essentially a clean energy act in large measure in the United States, has brought down very dramatically through what it offers the costs of solar and wind and other forms. Of course, those are forms which are already pretty cheap, and that's why you're seeing so much expansion in renewables, clean sources of energy in the United States, but also in China itself, of course. China is adding 200 gigawatts or more a year in solar. That's enormous. The total electricity capacity of the UK is 80, and they're adding 200 or so a year. And when Xi Jinping says you've got to build the new before you run down the old, you can understand why, but my goodness, they're building the new. And even though you're going to see upticks around energy security and so on, that trend is very powerful. But where does that leave us? Well, the fact that you've got these measures with very strong emphasis on local content, in protectionist in many ways, taking place particularly in the rich countries of the world, does bring its risks. And it risks a perpetuation of what we've seen, where the level of investment in the new technologies is much lower in emerging markets and developing economies. It risks efficiency and it risks tensions around trade. So let me, now I've got to keep an eye, how much longer have I got, Liz?
We've got 15 minutes.
Okay, so I'm going to go fast over the trade and technology because I've already touched on those points. And I'll be quick on land, forest, and biodiversity as well, not because they're unimportant, they're supremely important, but because I want to get to keep some decent time for the reform of the multilateral development banks and the financial institutions. So these are the areas where we're going to, if we're going to deliver on Paris, and that's the basic idea on which the whole lecture is founded, because if we don't, we're in deep trouble. If we're going to deliver on Paris, these are the areas where we have to collaborate internationally. On trade, I've already set out some of the problems. In order for this to, in order for those problems to be manageable, those local content, those protectionist aspects of the new incentive structures really have to be time limited, and time limited in a predictable way if the confidence for investors is going to be there. But remember what we should be looking for. And this is really a rather new thing in international trade in many ways. We are clear that there are key technologies and key resources for the transition we have to make. So what do we need as a world? We need those costs to fall rapidly, and we need the supply chains to be resilient. How do you get that? Well, you need quite a few players because you want the economies of scale. You need quite a few players to get the competition that's going to give you the innovation. And you need quite a few players to give you the resilience. So the idea of European Union, the United States, China and India and Indonesia and elsewhere starting to build up those capacities and competing with each other is a good thing. But what you want to do is to have that story so that you build them up, but then you take down the barriers. And that's something which we have to plan for and insist on from the beginning. Lots we can do together on technology. And one of the good things about COP26 in Paris was the emphasis on collaboration around technologies and the private sector itself being involved in that. Lots of detail on that that really does matter. Of course, the cost of capital will be absolutely critical to these technologies. I keep saying it because it's so important, because these are technologies which bring your capital up front so that you can save on the current costs, particularly the fossil fuel current costs down the track. We clearly have to collaborate around forests. We all benefit from the good functioning of forests, and we're all in peril if the Amazon basin collapses, for example, and we lose out on that extraordinary sink for carbon. So collaborating internationally to help with the resources which are going to sustain those forests is very important. I think the voluntary carbon markets can play some part in that process. Philanthropies can play some parts in the process, but essentially building a model of development which allows incomes to rise in ways which do not involve the cutting down of the forest is a big part of the story. So you have to integrate it into a whole story of investment. Lots the international world can do now by collaborating around satellite monitoring and really understanding what's going on. A really big, very important subject, which I list some of the issues here, haven't got time to do justice to right now, but it is an international challenge. There has been some momentum, and it's interesting to see that there have been some successes. The Montreal Protocol around restoring the ozone layer actually worked. And we did actually have an ozone layer that did have holes in it, and those holes have started to close, indeed gone a long way in closing. So when we talk about the difficulties of international collaboration for global public goods, we talk about a real problem. But we shouldn't talk about it in a way that there's no way that we can overcome that problem, particularly in this case if we have the alternative story of growth and the role of natural capital within that story. So I think if you, one of the lessons that I've learned from all this is the more specific you are, the easier it is to get action. And the ozone layer and the HCFCs and the phasing out of those was a very specific challenge. There were substitutes, but the substitutes were accelerated as a result of the agreement, and we saw that that worked. I think there's future in the taxation of maritime fuels, again, because it's specific and monitorable, and it's something that that specificity is going to be a big part of success on this. You can get, you know, if you, we've on the whole stopped the killing of whales. I mean, not quite well enough, but that did make a big difference. So on specific kinds of collaboration, it is possible to get somewhere, but design is very important. Now, we know, and you're familiar, I hope, anyway, you would have been if you'd been to the preceding lectures, with these kinds of diagrams. The green is where we're supposed to go, and the shaded area is roughly where we are going on the basis of current policies and actions. There are various targets and pledges associated with trying to meet those targets, which would take us on down. But it is quite clear now that we're going to overshoot 1.5. And the longer we're above 1.5, the bigger the damage. So the first lesson from that is to accelerate the emissions reductions, to try to bring down as far as possible the time. But we are going to have some negatives, so it's important that we discuss what, how we get those negatives. And of course, a lot of the difficulties associated with that. You can think of the negatives, and I'll be explicit about some of them, but I haven't got time to go into the detail. There's a lot of negatives that come through storing carbon in land and forests, and that must be the healthiest and most attractive way of storing the carbon. Restoring degraded land is good for productivity, it's good for resilience, and it's good for storing carbon. It's an argument for restoring degraded land overwhelming. Peatland, of course, very powerful store of carbon. So those natural sources of carbon are the cheapest and, in many ways, the most attractive because they're restoring our natural capital, which is a big part of sustainability. But some of those, not all of them, but some of those are less permanent than others. Forests can burn down. Forests can get hacked down. We have to think also of the numbers and how much we can get that way. And many of our colleagues and some of the in the Energy Transition Commission, some of our friends in Energy Transition working that have been here. But we're going to have to look at other forms. Now, it's amazing, actually, there are quite a lot of forms of carbon capture. You can capture it in rocks. You can capture it through through algae. We've already spoken about the natural ways of doing things. But you can also set up great big fans and suck in the air and put it through a filter and pull it out from that. At the moment, because the quantity of the CO2, the density of the CO2 in the air is low, even though the concentrations are high from the point of view of global warming, they're low from the point of view of the amount of CO2 in any given volume of air, that is a very energy-intensive way of doing it. So the cost now, currently, of this direct air capture, this sort of fan-based method, is somewhere somewhere between $600 and $1,100 per tonne, right? Where if you think of a lot of the costs around forests and restoring degraded land, you're talking about much less, 10, 20, 50. And so it's clear that at the moment these things are much more expensive than doing it the natural way. Algae looks quite promising. One of our good friends is bashing away at algae. But if you can bring direct air capture costs down to $100 a ton, then actually it starts to become interesting. Imagine No, we've got CO2 equivalent now of 57-58 billion tons or gigatons a year. Those are the flows. We can bring it down and bring it down, but that last 10 is going to be quite difficult. For example, you know, you've got cattle and so on who are going to emit greenhouse gases. There'll be some areas where it's going to be more difficult. There'll probably be some laggards. That last 10, imagine if you're trying to get that last 10 gigatons out and it costs $100 a ton, that's $1 trillion a year. Well, in a world GDP that by then, you know, will be perhaps $2 trillion a year, that's not a bad deal, yeah? It's much better to stop the emissions because we can now see how to do that in a clean and attractive way. But as a backstop, it's something that we ought to investigate. Now, on the other hand, carbon capture and storage is usually a term usually used when you capture it at source. You capture it in a power station or you capture it in a cement factory. And again, that's much cheaper than direct air capture. So it's very important to look at those things and bring the cost down as much as we can. But I do think we ought to have a constant emphasis on two things, bringing down the emissions in the first place and highlighting and prioritising the natural ways, because they're much better for the whole story of development which we're trying to picture. Now, beyond that, there's increasing attention on geoengineering, and that essentially tries to erect a mask, tries to stop the energy coming in the first place. That emphasis in these areas is something which is understandable, but in many ways deeply worrying, because we don't really know what the consequences of pursuing those kinds of things are. I guess it's important that we need to understand those a bit better than we do, but they're very real and difficult things to understand about the risks that come with all this. You know, if you fire dirt or particulates up in the atmosphere to stop energy coming in, the consequences of doing that could be deeply dangerous and of a kind we don't really understand. All kinds of problems about governance too. Who takes those decisions? What right do they have to take the decisions? What happens if they suddenly you start stop doing it? You know, there are whole areas of problems, but there are problems which we as social scientists have to examine, and they're things that which probably our scientific friends have to try to understand the consequences of doing all this. They're deeply worrying, in my view, and the best thing of all is not to have to go there. Now, let me spend the last bit of time that I've got. How much time have I got?
Five, 6, 7 minutes.
OK, well, I may take 8 or 9.
That's fine.
Where are we now? And I want to spend the last time really on climate finance. I've already emphasised that climate finance is picking up, but that it's very focused on the richer countries and China. And the if you look at the energy transition, developed countries in China have attracted over 90% of the increase in clean energy investment in the last 3 or 4 years. The central challenge here is to get investment going, resources flowing, finance flowing into emerging markets and developing countries outside China. In one sentence, that's the biggest of all our problems, and that's where we have to focus our attention. It's on the intersection of economics and finance, but the economics is absolutely at the core. It's also that finance is concentrated in mitigation, and the amount of private sector finance is much weaker than it should be. So we don't start in a very good place, but we are seeing movements in good directions. Now, Rachel and I were on the G20 independent experts group on multilateral development banks, particularly in relation to the sustainable development goals and climate finance. We did 2 reports last year, and the leadership of the Indian G20 was extremely important here in all this. And we had 2 reports. The first one was the triple agenda. You've got to add the public goods to the mandate of those institutions. Previously, there mostly were poverty and shared prosperity. You've got to add the third. You've got to triple the level of finance. and you've got to explore different funding mechanisms. And we argued that they had to be better, bolder, bigger, better in the sense to operate in a much more friendly way to its customers, to collaborate much better. Bolder, they ought to take on more risk and work with the private sector. And bigger, they've had to triple the flow of funds. If you look at what's necessary to do that in terms of the capital you need to inject into them, it's very small. And again, the numbers, just how small, but essentially you're talking about very modest sums from the shareholders of those institutions, in all because they can be very heavily leveraged from paid-in capital to callable capital, and then from overall capital you can leverage in all kinds of ways, including using guarantees and so on. So this tripling that we're talking about is actually entirely feasible at very low cost, but it does involve quite big changes in those institutions. When I say necessary, I always mean, in this context, necessary for delivery on Paris. Yeah. I've used necessary a lot. I started with Paris, and I meant necessary for delivery on Paris. And not delivering on Paris, as we've argued several times over these last 3 days, is immensely dangerous. So it's not, as it were, when we're talking about these finances, we're talking about some kind of opening bid, and we're going to negotiate and end up in the middle. No, this is about what is necessary to deliver on Paris. If you say it can't be done, then you're saying it can't be done. And that's a much bigger problem than actually doing it, even though it's very difficult. So you've got to get an investment climate where people want to make investments. They've got to be confident that they can build whatever it is they need to build. They've got to be confident that if they're selling electricity, there's going to be somebody buying it at reasonable prices who's actually going to pay when push comes to shove. These are the kinds of things that we mean by the investment climate. They're starting to build in different forms in different places, international cooperation to support that. The multilateral development banks have a role to play there. Many countries are burdened with debt and fiscal constraints. The international financial institutions, particularly the IMF, have a duty to lead the charge in sorting those things out. So when we talk about finance, you've got to overcome the problems of investment climate, and you've got to, in many countries, deal with the problems of debt. And you've got to deal with the issues around fiscal rules. Borrowing for good investment is fiscally responsible. And some of the quality of the argument in this country has been very poor on that particular subject. I'll say it again. Borrowing for good investment is fiscally responsible. It brings down the debt to GDP ratio over time. Why? Because it kicks up and gives you the kind of growth you need. Of course, the clean growth, much better than the path we've followed in the past. These are the numbers. If you just look at the bottom line here, the pink line, the sums involved in terms of financing for investment are on the right-hand side. The investments we need to make are on the left-hand side, the bigger part being energy transition, all of this being the emerging markets, developing economies outside China. So create the conditions for investment and then bring together the different sources, four different sources essentially: domestic resource mobilization, the multilateral development banks, private finance, and the bilateral and other flows. Again, perhaps in the discussion, it's something perhaps Rachel might pick up. All the way in which we put those different flows together is critically important, because that's what helps you manage risk and bring down the cost of capital. So it's not the total only that matters. The total does matter, but it's not the total only. It's the blending of those different forms of finance. We've got Kat Sathulkar in the audience today, who spends a life on blended finance. And the way in which you actually do that is enormously important to the degree to which you can bring down the cost of capital and make these great investments actually financeable. In Africa, solar is tremendously attractive. It beats out fossil fuel, but not if the cost of capital is 20-some percent. It does when it's a much more reasonable, around 6, 7, 8%. And that's why we have to get there. So let me finish with modest notes of optimism, but with keen concern about the magnitude of the challenges that we have to make. We know we have to move, and we know we have to move fast. The Sustainable Development Goals have within them the whole climate story. But the climate story gives you a deadline. If you don't get that right, then you really blow out of the water your chances to get the other parts of the Sustainable Development Goals right. So this is a story of challenges which are absolutely interwoven. There's a very optimistic story about the new form of growth which is available to us if we just make the investment and the systemic changes that we need. Not growth forever, of course, we're talking about the next 20 or 30 years, but a very different form of growth from the dirty, destructive paths that have gone before. That's in our hand, in our hands. Where we want to go is tremendously attractive, but the route there is not easy. It is a growth story route, but it does mean tackling the kind of problems and the dislocations, particularly which we referred to in the last lecture. And when things are tough, but when the rewards are great, and when the punishment for not doing it is immense, those are the moments when you really need leadership and you really need work from people like you and the rest of us working on how to solve those problems. The social sciences are absolutely at the core of this, but our economists have not yet been working sufficiently in a focused way on the analytics of dynamic and structural change. These are not simple equilibrium growth models. These are models of growth and structural change, systemic change. I went into some detail yesterday on that. They do involve a different picture of the role of the state, because we know we have to push hard in a certain direction, and we're going to need public policies that take us in that direction and collaboration that takes us in that direction. There's lots of issues here about justice and fairness, and we need public discussion of those issues in order to get the political momentum around solving them. All this is absolutely at the core of the social sciences, and we have a big job to do. But this is my yes we can slide, and my last slide. I've emphasised the difficulties, but I've also emphasised that we have a pretty clear understanding of where we have to go and why it's an attractive destination and why the route itself is also quite attractive if we can overcome our problems. There isn't any shortage of global savings. Overall investment rates have been low, historically speaking, in these last 15 or 20 years. We've seen manifestations of, in Keynesian terms, of planned saving being in excess of planned investment. And what's happened is that growth rates have come down, investment is too low. What's the answer to that? In Keynesian terms, it's to increase the level of investment. It makes good sense. It's good macro here, as well as, of course, primarily tackling the problems that we have to tackle. The technical change has been absolutely remarkable. When we did the Stern Review now, what was 2006, we couldn't have predicted and didn't predict, anyway, we didn't predict that the cost of solar would be something like a tenth or less now, which it is, than it was then. We didn't predict that the electric vehicle, the purchase price of the electric vehicle, probably in a year or two around the world, is going to be cheaper than the purchase price of the internal combustion engine vehicle. And of course, if you take the cost over the lifetime, it's already cheaper. We didn't predict that either. All the major car companies are moving very strongly in that direction. So the technical change has been remarkable. I don't want to take it for granted, but it has meant, I think, that the statement that these are now largely social science issues, economics, politics, society, I think is now clear. We've got, you know, the Paris Agreement many people thought would be impossible. Just read The Economist issue before the Paris Agreement. It wasn't one of its most distinguished issues, and it got that wrong. We can do things. We've learned much more how to do things. That doesn't mean they're easy, but I think it does mean they're not impossible. I think young people now, particularly across the world, it depends, of course, which state they've been educated in the United States, but across the world, young people have been taught about the whole issue of climate change, and they're putting pressure on us in a very sensible way. Not just pressure to do something, but actually knowledgeable pressure about what it is that we have to do. And increasingly, and we saw it very strongly in COP26 in Glasgow, the private sector is seeing that this is the investment and the growth of the future. So, to coin a phrase, yes, we can. But will we? That's our job. I worry, but that's our job. Thank you very much.
I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
It was a tour de force, just for one night, and we've had 3 days of this, and we overuse the phrase national treasure, Nick, but you are up there. It's an extraordinary overview of what needs to be done and what can be done. It's both a roadmap as well as a sort of diagnostic. And it was in 2006 when you first said, you know, the cost of inaction will be far higher than the cost of action. And you end the last slide at the end of 3 extraordinary lectures with, how do we turn the can into the will? And we're still struggling with that. And we've had generations of politicians cycle through, and we're still struggling with, if you know that the costs of inaction are higher than the cost of action, if the climate crisis is not a black swan event visible in a rearview mirror, but a grey rhino charging down the pathway towards you, where do you muster the will from? We're not unintelligent. Our leaders, in the main, are not unintelligent, although every now and again we test that proposition. So I think what I want to focus on a little bit is what I've picked up through the lectures, which I watched the other two and listened to today. And I want to actually challenge the audience a little bit. Nick can't do this on his own. The comprehensive and detailed assessment, you know, focuses very much on the energy transition, food and land transition, the financial transition. But perhaps even more so than in 2006, at the beginning of this piece of the journey, we have to deliver against that in this very, very fast-changing world, but a fundamentally different world that is emerging. So we're still in an economic global order where the dominance remains, at least structurally, in the West. But I would posit to you that before we get to 2050, our net zero target, that will have shifted quite considerably. We're shifting emphasis and power and ideas and the perhaps maybe some of the big bets to the East and to the South. The liberal West's voice is also not commanding the attention that it once did, in part because we are no longer trustworthy, something that you've also written about, not perceived as trustworthy, never, at least. What do I mean by that? It is the limits of do as we say and not do as we do. At the end of the day, from those graphs, the rapid decarbonisation of the industrial world is a prerequisite for everything else that has to happen. Yes, we need to restore land and steward land and forests, in particular where forests still exist as standing forests. It's the Amazon, it's the Congo Basin, it's Indonesia. Yes, we must do all of that, but we have to decarbonise rapidly. China has to change its emissions trajectory, which it is doing. India will have to grow green, something that no major country has ever had to do, and we will have to help. And mustering the will for that, as opposed to mustering the will for domestic action for the benefit of the domestic population, is something which continues to prove to be difficult. We've seen the introduction of green industrial policy now, belatedly, perhaps in some respects, in both the United States, the Inflation Reduction Act, and in Europe, and now the introduction of CBAMs and trade measures. Now, CBAM is having a profound effect already. The number of companies across Asia in particular that are getting their CBAM reporting into shape because they see the shape of things to come is a good thing. But yet politically and from a societal perspective, people are afraid of a new green trade barrier, simply locking them out of the kinds of decisions that need to be made by this new multilateralism that Nick called for. But embedded in the IRA, which we've also mentioned here, is some extraordinary subsidy. The biggest subsidy goes to direct air capture. The biggest subsidy goes to carbon capture and storage and use. Well, why? I mean, from a frictional political point of view, because that's what the lobby needed in order to get the rest of it through the Congress, in particular in a Congress which is 50-50 with Joe Manchin standing in the middle. But it's also the numbers that were given by the oil and gas companies for what they would need to be able to expand direct air capture to scale, in particular Occidental in the Permian Basin. But also, the net effect of that will be that the United States positions itself as the global competitor or leading competitor for all of the technologies in direct air capture and carbon capture, storage and use. So you can imagine a world where the EU has, you know, a lock-in on some of the technologies in renewable energy, obviously China does, and the US becomes the sort of granddaddy of direct air capture and carbon capture, storage and use technologies. That's going to be another part of the economic geography that Nick talked about. But at the same time, these tectonic plates of the US, China, and the EU are sort of grating against each other. Different taxonomies of sustainable finance, different approaches to regulation and supervision of the financial sector. We saw last week the Securities Exchange Commission of the United States decide that we don't need to report on Scope 3 in the United States, Scope 3 being your supply chain. Well, in what world, in what global trade world, in a world where you only have one planet, as Ban Ki-moon first said, is it possible that somebody is not in somebody's Scope 3? Everybody's Scope 1 is somebody's Scope 3. You know, we should have T-shirts made. Right? So we see this interconnected world where I think, and we saw this in service of the Indian government and the G20 last year, but also Brazil this year, that they're not exactly waiting anymore for sort of permission to sort of join the global dialogue. There is an impetus. There is a feeling that the answers are going to come from different parts of the globe. And if Brazil, for example, just brought all the forested nations together and said, we're just going to establish a floor price for carbon related to forests, it would have a seismic effect. They're not going to wait for either sort of an impulse to come from Washington or Brussels, but they're also not going to wait for the environmental community of northern-based NGOs to decide what's the best thing to do either and sell them an idea. It's moving, and it's moving to the east and moving to the south. But let me go back to this trustworthiness. One of the things, and one of the most important conversations, well, it wasn't the most important, but it's the one that stayed with me, conversations I had in Dubai and then followed up in Davos. Yeah, I'm one of those people that goes to these things. Is somebody from the Gulf, from one of the major oil-producing countries of the Gulf, who said to me, look, we're not encumbered by democracy. I thought, well, it's very interesting that you think that, you know, democracy would be an encumberment. And the point that they were making is that they can make long-term planning decisions, and they can pursue them with a certain amount of boldness, and they can put money behind those decisions. And I'm not here to comment on their democracy or ours or the quality of theirs. I can comment openly on the quality of ours. But the point is that this ability to make long-term planning decisions and stick to them is something that we've lost our way on in the West. So we will need innovation in democracy in order to be able to deliver on this agenda, as much as we will need innovation in economic policy and in technical progress. And that's what I came away, having listened and watched this extraordinary opus, is where will that come from? We need the innovation in democracy because this agenda is an inclusive one, but we need the innovation in democracy because people are switched off, and yet the decisions that we have to make to deliver on this agenda, we haven't been able to make on a systematic basis over the last 15 years, and so now time's up. Now we have to make them. And the way in which decisions are made, in particular as it flows up into the international financial institutions, leave out a lot of people. So if you look at who uses what electricity and how they use it, and you actually talk to women in the village, and then you build up a picture, you come up with a very different number than if you sit in a boardroom somewhere in the developed world and think about gigatons through lines of a centralised energy system. And I can repeat that analogy again and again and again. So who decides, and how do we prioritise? And then I'm up for time, and so we'll open it up for Q&A. But I also wanted to just reflect on what this means for you, on the assumption that most of you in the audience and most of the students here, maybe online, are a generation below or nudging up against me, is that we have, because of this lack of trustworthiness, because we let the world down on vaccines, we haven't delivered on climate finance, we are inconsistent in the way that we apply international law. We're inconsistent and seem to be inconsistent in the way we think about trade policy and financial policy. And we've been slow to reform the institutions that we built in the middle of the last century because we had a vision of a liberal order that was based on law. And we've sort of got a bit loose with that. So our trustworthiness means that we now don't have all the tools available to us to move through the kinds of international agreements we're going to need going forward. Look at the Plastics Convention negotiation. Very, very interesting. But the forces at play that will weaken or dilute that convention are exactly the same powers that would undermine agreement in either a COP or perhaps in other fora. At the end of the day, it's the same argument about the continuation of one industry, one practice. But we've seen innovation in democracy at the international level. The Sustainable Development Goals, while not a binding treaty, were the biggest ever crowdsourcing enterprise that the world has ever gone through. We've seen that the experimentations with citizens' assemblies, especially around issues of climate, have proven to be somewhat successful. And these experiments may be something that you will have to do. And when it comes to the discussion about solar radiation modification, the next generation of carbon dioxide removals, and that word that is not used by the scientists, as Jimsky said yesterday, because it gets misused, but geoengineering, we will not be able to have a discussion about how to think about the international science behind that, nor a conversation about how we govern our world where that's possible, unless we embrace this flat world where the power is moving to the south and to the east. It will be inconceivable to the Indians or to the Indonesians or the South Africans or the Kenyans or anybody else that the technology and the framework for that convention should be defined in Harvard, University of Chicago, or in London or Frankfurt or New York. They have the technological capability to be equals at the table, and it will be a very, very different kind of global governance conversation, unlike anything that we've seen over the last 80 years. It's the difference between Versailles and the peace agreements that came in the second half of the 20th century. And that's something that you will have to build. But there will have to be the voices of people in that discussion. People will have to understand what it means to govern technologies that will be put into space. My final point is that there's some very interesting research with young people in the north of Finland, in the Arctic Circle, in the Arctic countries, who have been arguing for climate action for as long as we've been talking about it, but who now have reached the point where they understand that in the absence of climate action, they actually need these new technologies. And they've moved from being completely opposed to geoengineering to actually being prepared to experiment with it, but only if they have a voice at the table. So we can go from we can to we will, but the we will be bigger, and the we will depend on new structures of democracy.
Thank you so much, Rachel. That was a really inspiring talk. I think especially for our younger generation.
I don't know the number, but of how many countries will be having elections this year. Mm-hmm. But for many of the younger generation, it includes both my daughters, it's the first time they'll have a chance to vote in national elections. And it's really important that you all have your voice heard, because we need an innovation in democracy, you said, but we need the younger generation who are going to be most affected to participate. So I just was waffling a little bit because I wanted to make sure you all were thinking about your questions. And I just want to thank Nick again for that was your, you must be quite relieved in a way if you've got half an hour still on form to answer questions, but what a huge amount of energy and inspiration from three evenings talking to us about the new growth story. So it's much appreciated. Should we just give Nick another applause? I think we'll start with questions from the live ones, from the in-person audience. I'm going to hope to see three hands from a variety of spaces and a variety of generations. So I'm going to go, and you're going to, we're going to three at a time. One there in the front, you're number two, and then number three there, and we'll have plenty more time. But please keep your questions short, and I'll make sure the answers are not too long either.
Well, thank you very much. Oil companies are incentivized by gross profits to keep on destroying this planet. And with these billions upon billions and billions of pounds of profit, they buy not only governments, but whole political systems within a country. And of course, promote oil wars, which means the ending of human beings being able to shape their own lives. So with this in mind, should we take anybody seriously who is not proposing the immediate nationalisation of all oil companies in the West, and then backdate their profits as well and take that from them? And with this money, we can then fund all the programmes and many other programmes as well to stop this horror. You said we have to move fast, and I've not heard anything from you yet that absolutely backs that statement up, that nationalising all oil companies would. Thank you.
Thank you for a nicely focused question. And we've got a question here at the front.
Thank you, Professor Strang, for a wonderful lecture series. My name is Avantika, and I'm doing Masters in Local Economic Development here at LSE. I have two questions to ask you. The first question is referring to your yesterday's presentation. I have glanced at the slide called Investing in Forest, and I'm curious what are your thoughts behind the idea of investing in forest. The second question is regarding the Indian mangroves, especially in delta area of the Sundarban Delta, which is in West Bengal, which has been declined since centuries, and it is more than 40%, and it is because of the human settlements and agricultural practices which is now more than 80% of the reason why they are declining. So what do you think who are more responsible? Because the opportunity cost for the agriculture encroachment and the disaster or the calamities of the degradation of the Sundarban Delta is very much high, and we cannot go back to what happened now at the previous. So do you think are the people, the local people who are the responsible, who just wanted to make their basic needs, or it is the responsibility of government who are not taking any actions, or are taking but we have not seen any significant amount of improvements? Thank you.
Thank you so much. Two questions about responsibility and from totally different areas. That's great. And our third question of this round.
Hello, my name is Maria. I'm from the UK Baha'i Office of Public Affairs, and thank you so much for your wonderful just knowledge that you shared with us tonight. And I'm just a bit worried when we're talking about the kind of restructuring of power in the world, shifting from Western nations to East and South, that actually when we see great power shifts in history and in the past, we see it either happening very violently and with a lot of conflict, or we see it happening with a lot of pushback from the countries in which, because we see it as a zero-sum game, and we see power as something that's finite and can only be kind of shared so far without it being diluted, that I worry that, especially when it comes to multilateralization and within the UN's veto vote and the idea that countries are not we don't really see any push to give that vote to more countries or to take that vote away altogether, that actually the ego of politics will overshadow the needs of the planet and the people that we are supposed to be, and we have a duty towards, we have a moral duty towards. And I was just wondering how you see, like, what kind of education can be imposed to kind of help this structure, or what kind of dangers need to be mitigated in this regard, or where you see hope coming in this kind of picture.
Thank you. So over to Nick and Rachel.
Yeah, Rachel will have a lot to say about all those, but let me go first. A lot of the world's oil companies are already nationalised. If you look at Saudi Aramco, if you look in the Gulf, the biggest part of the challenge is to reduce the demand for their products. Taxing their products, we can tax their profits. But if we're going to move quickly, we've got to follow policies that we can actually put into practice quickly. And that's the challenge. If you wanted to persuade United States to nationalise ExxonMobil.
Sorry, I meant a world nationalisation, not just a country, but the whole world, world yeah. bank, but actually
remember,
not a nationalisation.
Most people can't hear you because you're not on...
Yeah.
on
no, but can I... Yeah. No, let me... Yeah. I'll try to repeat what you said so that people off outside here will be able to understand. The idea is, I argued just now that a lot of the world's oil companies are nationalised in the sense that they're owned by the states which are associated with them. But the question was, I'm sorry, I hadn't fully understood the question. Do you have the idea of some kind of world government that just takes over all companies? That doesn't sound to me, it's an interesting idea. It doesn't sound to me like something you can do in a hurry, because you've got to have a world government that exists, that's got the power to do all that. I think to get to that position would take a lot longer than working to reduce very sharply the demand for the products, because after all, it's the demand for their products together with the supply that produces the result of the pollution that we want. So move very rapidly on that front, and that's in large measure what I was talking about right through these 3 days, how to reduce the demand for their products. I think taxing their, particularly taxing the windfall profits that we've seen in these last 2 or 3 years, around the war profits, if you like, around what's happened in the last 2 or 3 years. That's also a route that we can follow. But that route is followed country by country. The prospect of having world nationalisation and world taxation in real time quickly, I think, is small. And we're in a hurry, and I was trying to find ways, and others trying to find ways of moving very quickly. On the investing in forests and in mangroves, that's very close to my heart. The one charitable trust of which I'm a member is Sanctuary in India, which is, you know, originated by the wonderful Bittu Sagal. You probably know Bittu. And there's a tremendous amount you can do around creating incomes from the forests. And, you know, one example like that is buffer zones around national parks, where the people who own the land, you can work with them to collectively turn that land into a buffer zone, and then they can get income from the animals very quickly come there. And you can get income from the tourists who come through, you know, taxation of the hotels and the lodges and so on. And those are real ways of making money. And in order to get the investment, you need to have revenue sources. I think increasing, of course, the productivity of agriculture outside the forest so that they feel they don't have to go into the extensive margin and cut down the forest. There's a tremendous amount that you can do there. And, of course, finding ways of pricing the services which the forests give in terms of capturing carbon and so on. All those things are things that we have to pursue. Mangroves are fundamental. I mean, you know it extremely well. But mangroves are wonderful at capturing carbon. Of all the trees, they're right up there on the at the best end of the spectrum for capturing carbon. They are the natural barriers against storm surges, and they're very good for the fisheries. They are a prime example of a form of investment and activity that's good development, good mitigation in terms of capturing carbon, and good adaptation. And so it seems to me that investing in mangrove is right up, you know, if you think of the two single things that really have the highest returns on investment for the world, it's girls' education and mangroves. So we're absolutely on the same page of that. Of course, you have to do them all. There's so many other things you have to do as well. And I do think that there are credible programs now for replanting the mangroves down the east coast of India and Bangladesh. And it seems to me if the world's going to invest, that would be right up the top of my list. The changing power structures, and do power structures change without some kind of conflict? That's a difficult one. And the great Graham Allison in Harvard writes books on all this. And I think that recognizing common interest is a fundamental route to avoiding that. And the one area where the world is better, not good, but better at recognizing common interest than elsewhere is climate change. You did get the Paris Agreement. It did have an effect. The first thing, when the relationships between China and the US went really frosty after Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan, the first thing that was put back on the list was climate change. And actually, I mean, Rachel and I were with John Kerry and Xie Jianwei at the time that happened, and the handshake in Bali at the G20, and they laughed, the two of them. We saw them in sequence, but they said, look, we kept on talking to each other because we're friends, and now we can talk to each other in public. And it's a small observation, but it's an indication that is the area where collaboration, because of a shared common interest and because of the perceived gains from following the different route as well as avoiding disaster, that's an area where I think we can hope that the two rising power, no, obviously the rising power relative to of China relative to the US, I do think that's first on the list of areas of collaboration. And if you collaborate productively in one place, I think it improves the chances of collaborating elsewhere. So I don't think that's inevitable. Sparta rising against Athens causes the Peloponnese, all the wars and so on. I don't think it's inevitable, and it's climate, actually, because of the magnitude of the challenge, that makes me a bit more optimistic than that.
So very briefly, just to add on to that, I think that I would completely agree with Nick that climate has been the place where the conversation has continued to happen. And there are other places that we have to protect the ability to cooperate, including, for example, in the boards of the MDBs and in the IMF. And these have been zones of cooperation where things have been able to get done, even though we're at this moment of maximum stress, because in great power theory, right, it is at the moment when a rising power and a weakening power are sort of close to parity. Well, I mean, you could argue that this decade that's where China and the US are at. But where I think it's going to get complicated is that, and you see this now in President Lula's stance as the G20 president, is that climate is now becoming a fundamental issue of global macroeconomic policy. You know, is the IMF big enough? You know, how are we going to manage the debt rescheduling? How are we going to help countries be able to manage their way through the increasing costs of climate change and the fact that that's now a lived experience for everybody? So we're now into this really fragile state where the demand for a bigger seat at the table for some of the rising emerging powers becomes louder and louder. I'm not going to talk about the Security Council and what the UN does. That's too complicated. But I think that we'll see more of that. And then just on nationalisation, understanding that you were talking about a global or world nationalisation, I think that in addition to sort of getting the way in which those companies are taxed correctly, is it, they are valued, right? The ones that are privately owned, who are only 20% of the global oil supply, right? They are valued on the basis of their proven reserves. Their proven reserves cannot be developed and exploited. And so they are valued you know, in a strange way for this world. And so how we change that, I don't know. But this is a Robbins lecture. Robbins had his fights with Keynes back in the 30s, right? And the one thing I think that we've still got to do is to, and I'm not an economist, so I'll defer to Nick, is the valuing of nature, right? The valuing of some of the things that don't get valued properly in our economies today.
Rachel, Liz and I are working as hard as we possibly can to bring down the value of oil companies as fast as we possibly can by removing the demand for their product.
Thanks.
Yeah, I think the pragmatic, the speed ultimately, isn't it, is a combination of what we want to achieve and what's pragmatic in quite a short period of time, you know, 26 years. And I think we're on the same page at least, and it's good to explore these different ways of doing that. Martin, we might have some questions online.
Yeah, we've got a couple here. One from Peter Liao, an LSE student here, has a question for the panel. Citing whether there's any unfairness in the share of stock and voting rights in international organisations like the IMF, but pointing to Africa's appeal for reform from the UN Security Council, and asks whether you think they'll be likely to get security on their climate funding. And another question from Ali Henderson, who's read reports in the Financial Times about large asset managers quitting Climate Action 100. And it looks like they're concerned about investor groups leaving companies set up to push global climate change sort of reform. And they're worried that it's being seen as climate investment is being seen as something for do-gooders rather than capitalists. Is there a way to overcome that issue?
The shares of In the international institutions, the World Bank, the IMF, and of course the oldest ones in this context, dating back to, it's almost exactly 80 years. It's March 13th, 14th, wasn't it? The Bretton Woods agreement got together. So it's almost exactly 80 years. And it doesn't. You don't have to have an LSE education to work out the world's changed quite a lot in 80 years. So that structure of the shares doesn't really make any sense. But then we come back to the question of what can we do fast? Yeah? And the United States will tell you, and Democrat or Republican, and we've had this discussion, Rachel and I, over many years with many Secretaries of Treasury of the United States, they'll say, fine to reform the voting shares as long as our share doesn't go below 17%, which gives us the veto. Yeah? And so in taking a pragmatic real-time view, what matters most of all, and I did emphasize it in what I said today, is a very big expansion in the financing capability of these international. I'm looking at you, Martin, as I reply, because the question came from you, but I can't see directly the person who asked the question. That's the big challenge. Increasing very quickly their ability to lend. And that will come in part from the way they do things, whether they use more guarantees and so on, whether they take more risk, but it'll also come in part from paid-in capital. Very modest amounts of paid-in capital, and in those reports I mentioned, we quantify them. But that's the first priority. Let's get that increased. And actually, if those countries have more of the share of the capital than they should have, well, then let them kick in more according to their share, because that's how the capital increase would work. But it's still very modest sums. So if we wait and say we're going to arm wrestle over the shares before we turn to the expansion, we're just going to delay. So I absolutely agree, and I've been campaigning for a long time, most of us here, on those changes. If we insist on that happening before we embark down the road that we're trying to go on, we will delay. Seriously delay going down that road. Are the large asset managers getting cold feet? Well, in some places, and again, Rachel lives in the United States and is much closer to some of this, but some of the attorney generals of some of the states have actually been suing the companies, saying that by pursuing these kind of goals, they're reducing the value of the of the company and therefore not acting in the interest of the company, or if they're holding pension funds, they're not acting in the interest of the pension funds. And I had really two reactions to that. That is that the more we are successful in making the arguments which we must make and are making about very rapid change, the more the movement in the direction of investing in the green and the new is going to be looking after the interests of the pensioners whose money you're looking after. What's going to be profitable 30 years down the track when those pensions have to be paid out? Is it the technologies of the 19th and 20th century, or is it the technologies of the 21st century? So I think there's quite a powerful argument. If you take the long-run view, of, in this case, of a pension fund looking after the interests of the people it's minding the money for, that those investors are good investors. So I think the first part of the argument is that it could well be the responsible thing to do, even in the narrow sense of the relevant returns from the point of view of the obligations of those pensioners or financial companies. The second is that I think we have to live in a world, and this is part of this whole story, where firms are responsible for their stakeholders. And the stakeholders are many, including the people who work in the area where they work. If you remember sufficiently far back, the Bhopal disaster where the chemical factory killed so many people in its environment, firms are responsible for the stakeholders. They're responsible for the people around them. That's a big part of the notion of the role of the firm and the responsibilities of the firm. So I think there are two parts to that answer. We are trying to create circumstances where it is responsible, in terms of the narrow definition, to invest in these areas. But we're also, I think, at the same time, emphasising that the responsibilities of the firm and the role of the firm is much beyond simply short-run profits.
Just very briefly on maybe on the on this point, the Climate 100, Climate Action 100. So this is the green lash, right? This is this is what it's called now. And it's originated in the United States with, as Nick said, the more than 20 attorneys general. It's now also spread to sort of agricultural commissioners that are going after big food as well as they work through their transition plans for net zero. And it's predominantly been U.S., banks, U.S. asset managers, U.S. Asset owners that have pulled out. I think in this particular case, J.P. Morgan was the biggest one. And, you know, that's a reaction to, you know, a very tense situation in the United States, waiting for the SEC regulation to come out, which came out last week. It's an election year, and where you've got a deeply politicized, deeply oppositional narrative around climate and finance, where you saw Sarah Raskin blocked from joining the board of the Federal Reserve because she'd said, in, you know, correctly somewhere that, you know, climate was a risk. Well, Christine Lagarde first said that when she was at the IMF. She said it at the ECB. Kristalina Georgieva says it regularly. There is a macroprudential risk associated with not managing transitions and decarbonisation to the climate. So you can't say that in Washington, right? So JP Morgan steps out. Will they step back in next year? I don't know. But are they actually changing what they're doing? I think that's a big question. And then I think the other thing is that everybody else has stayed in. And there's some interesting research, I think, coming out of Penn and some other universities in the US around which tactics work best. And of course, over the last few years, the focus has been on shareholder resolutions. And then we saw Larry Fink sort of pull back from shareholder resolutions and State Street and Fidelity, the big asset managers in the US. But what we are seeing is maybe shareholder resolutions are not having the impact, and, you know, nobody's participating in them quite the same way. However, engagement strategies are working. And so I think you see asset owners and asset managers in particular still engaging with companies about, well, okay, what does your transition plan look like? When are we going to see it? How are, you know? So, and I think that seems to be still working, the research would show. So, yes, lots of drama, but does it change the fundamental economics of any of this? Does it change the science? No.
Gosh, all of a sudden, it's 8 o'clock, and with great regret, actually, we have to close this series of three evenings. But, before I end it, I just want to let everyone know there is a reception. We have it in the foyer of the theatre here, so just outside, and it's open to all attending the lecture, so there's plenty of times to talk and fire a few more questions at Nick and Rachel, perhaps, but let them get a drink first. And chat about ourselves, about, you know, what we do next, and to all be part of the solution, right? That's what we want to be. So I just want to thank you for taking the time to come here in person. Thank you for taking the time to join online. Thank you to our speakers, of course, for taking part. We're grateful for you, Rachel, for coming, for you, Nick, for always giving so much time to the LSC, GRI, and the planet in general. We're all on the same side here, I think. And thank you to the audience. So can we give one more round?
Listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.